We are getting to know owls a little better on the show today. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for listening to the Ideas Network. Carla Blum is on the phone with us today. She's the executive director of the International Owl Center. It's based in Houston, Minnesota, and we'll be talking about the center and their upcoming festival. They've got an owl festival coming up. And so she's here to talk all about owls and about that festival, and I hope you'll join in. Maybe you're intrigued about certain types of owls. Maybe you have a question about them. Call in. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org, or you can post your questions and photos. Maybe you've got a nice photo of an owl. Post it up on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to have you do that as well. And Carla Blum, welcome to the show. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
I always love to talk about owls, so thanks for letting me talk about owls.
I know. Well, I tell you what, maybe start with some info on the International Owl Center. What are you guys all about?
Well, we are the only all-owl education center in the United States, believe it or not. Which is not something we kind of intended to do. It started literally as an outgrowth of the Festival of Owls that we started as a hatch day party for Alice the Great Horned Owl, who was the one and only owl that worked at the Little Houston Nature Center. And within a few years, we had people flying in from all over the country in early March to come to our owl festival, and we thought, well, that's weird, because we're only a town of less than 1,000 people. And Minnesota is not usually where people from California want to go in early March. So as the festival grew, we kind of realized, hey, this is the only event of its kind in North America, so let's build on it, and we did. And as it grew, we realized there's a whole bunch of people that don't want to come to Houston, Minnesota in early March to learn about owls, and there isn't any center focused just on owl education. There's many raptor centers, but at a raptor center, they're talking about hawks, eagles, ospreys, falcons, harriers, a variety of different birds. But owls are so different and so unique. The fun thing about having an owl center is that we can go way more in depth with owls than they can anywhere else, because we're just focused on owls.
Yeah, it's really cool. What species of owls do we have in the upper Midwest?
The main ones that people are going to encounter are great horned owl, barred owl, and you have to enunciate so you know it's barred, B-A-R-R-E-D versus B-A-R-N, because those are two very different species. Yep. And the eastern screech owl. Those would be the most commonly encountered. Long-eared owls are certainly around, but generally a little more secretive and don't say as much, so people don't notice them as much. There's certainly saw-whet owls, more farther north, although in the winter they all come south and they'll go as far south as Kentucky, so some owl species are migratory. And then, of course, the farther north you are, the more likely you are to have snowy owls, great gray owls, hawk owls, boreal owls, things like that. And short-eared owls like grassland areas. So there's, depending on where you are, there's the common ones, and then there's the other ones that are here, there, and pop through, and things like that.
Yeah, very cool. Dave in Creston, Minnesota has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Dave. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah, I was just going to comment. We've been having a family of owls, barred owls, show up for the last 4 or 5 years, and they'll roost in a cottonwood above our garage, and they'll have their clutch or a bunch of babies, and they'll hang around until they all hatch, and then by late summer we'll end up having 5 or 6 of them. Some of the younger ones from generations seem to come back also after the babies hatch, and you can hear them every night, go out, watch them, and then by fall they'll just migrate across the river to the pines. And they seem to nest in the same tree year after year, same spot.
They found a good place, then, if they're nesting there year after year.
They have, and it kind of helps. There are some crows around that like to harass them. And I guess if I'm around or my wife's around, we'll go out and try and scare the crows away. We prefer the owls over the crows any day.
Yeah, the owl and crow thing is an age-old rivalry. And, yeah, so if you hear crows screaming and hollering, that's a good sign there may be owls somewhere around.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for calling, Dave. And they really don't like each other. I think it may have to do with predation, but I'm not positive, Carla. What, you know why it's so long existed?
Well, the main theory would be that, yes, owls do eat crows. So that's the main thing. And most birds are hatched out knowing that they hate something that looks like an owl. So even young birds will mob. They call it mobbing. And it's not just crows that do it for owls. Blue jays will do it for screech owls, chickadees, all kinds of birds mob owls. But, yeah, if you're an owl, you kind of eat anything that's smaller than you are.
There we go. Thanks again, Dave. Great call. Carl in Wausau. Let's go to you. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Larry. How you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What can we do for you?
Well, Carl is a buddy of mine. And one of the things that she has done a great deal of research on is owl vocalization. If you could get her to talk a little bit about Rusty and Iris and all of the things that she has done with them, I think your audience would find it really interesting.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. There's your opening, Carla. What about Rusty?
Okay. Well, Rusty and Iris are a non-releasable pair of great horned owls that I acquired back in 2010 to study the vocalizations of great horned owls. So I started studying great horned owl vocalizations in 2004 with Alice, my education bird, who's non-releasable, and then as well as all the wild owls in the area. And after a few years, I kind of realized there was quite a bit of information about the behaviors and vocalizations of owls that you couldn't study unless they were in captivity and breeding in captivity, because you can have the best webcam on the planet and all those young owls are going to leave the nest before they sound like adults. So when do they start sounding like adults? Do they have to practice first? Do boys do it before girls? How does this work? And they don't make transmitters that transmit audio, and they disperse all over, so you can't study that in the wild. So back in 2010, we got Rusty and Iris, who met in rehab. They both have eye issues and are non-releasable, but had kind of seemed to be a little sweet on each other in rehab. So we got them here so that we could breed them and raise babies in a large breeding and release training facility that's 96 feet long, monitored by 7 security cameras and microphones, so we can watch them without them knowing they're being watched. Because Rusty and Iris are not habituated to humans, and we don't want them to be. We want them to act as normally as possible, so that they raise their young to be wild and would behave as normally as you could have in a captive setting. So that's why we have Rusty and Iris.
So, and do you have them hunt mice or something, or what do you do?
Rusty and Iris just get provided with food. They're considered non-releasable because with vision in only one eye, they don't have the depth perception to be good hunters. So literally every night I chop up rats or rabbit or whatever and bring that out, and then I have a small door to a food tray. So I don't even enter their aviary. I just put the food in this little door onto a feeding tray. And then this time of year, you know, the male provides for the female. Very strict division of duties in owls. There's no sharing of incubation. The female does all the incubation. The male provides all the food. So Rusty's job's kind of easy. I've already got the food ready for him. And he's very good about bringing food over to Iris at the nest, way more than she would ever want. She's kind of busy bringing it away from the nest, like, yeah, I got enough. Can we cash this over here, please?
Well, what did, you know, Carl brought up about the vocalizations, and you were saying, you know, wondering whether the males start vocalizing earlier than the females and so forth. What are some of your findings from that?
The most incredible finding, and this is fun because this is a citizen science project. This isn't just me looking at things. We specifically have 2 of the cameras, one in the breeding pen and one in the flight pen, stream live online so that the people who are watching the cam are actually helping with the observations. And so we have observation forms that people can submit, and then our chat room moderators also will email me directly with their notes. And this is something that I missed, and I was actually watching at the time, and one of our chat room moderators from Oklahoma caught it. We had Rusty and Iris were in their aviary but away from the nest, and the owlets were about 2 weeks old. They were off the nest and away from the nest because the wild resident pair was in the yard, and of course they know that Rusty and Iris are here and they don't like having them within their territory, so they come over and hoot at them sometimes. So then Rusty and Iris get worked up, they get off the nest, they hoot back at them, and I was listening to the adults hooting, and our chat room moderator was paying attention to the babies. Now, there's one nest cam that's literally just 4 feet away from the nest bowl with a hypersensitive mic, and she realized that when those adults were hooting at the top of their lungs, the two oldest little chicks, who were only about 2 weeks old, were imitating those hoots, well, basically doing hoots, in their little itty-bitty voices with their little heads leaning forward just like the adults do. And they were doing and it was the correct rhythm for the gender. Everything about it was correct the very first time they did it when they were only 2 weeks old. So that was fascinating. Nobody had any idea they were capable of that. That's an adult for you.
There's an adult for you. Well, that is really, really a cool finding. And, of course, you don't get it without citizen participation there.
Right, right, because there's no way I can watch everything 24 hours a day or even review things 24 hours a day. So this, we get the live observations, the behaviors. And it's important to have the behaviors associated with the vocalizations, because if you just know they make a sound, well, so what? What does that mean? You need to know what context it's giving it given in, and having them in captivity allows us to see that context. But one of the other fun things about the development of those juvenile vocalizations is in midsummer, they sound for all the world like a teenage boy whose voice is changing. And it's hilarious. Nobody could take it seriously. It's, oh, 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 oh. It's almost there, but it's still squeaky.
Oh, man.
It's so funny. And then not until fall do they sound indistinguishable from an adult. So note what I found out after we started doing this research was that nobody had studied the vocal development of any owl species in the world yet. So that was interesting.
Oh, man. And so now, Lexi, do we have that that's a link to the monitors on our Facebook page? She's answering the phone now. She can't talk to me. But we need to link up so on our Facebook page so people can go to it. How would they find it otherwise?
If they go to Facebook, well, are you looking for the page where they can watch the cams?
Yeah.
If you go to internationalowlcenter.org, and even if you just type in a search for Owl Center or International Owl Center, we pop up real easy. And then on our website, on the top left, you're going to see a link that says Rusty and Iris Cam, and you click on that. And you'll see both the breeding pen cam and the flight pen cam, as well as a chat room where you can live chat and ask questions with our moderators.
Oh, man. Well, that's wonderful. We'll get that. We'll get Lexi to put that link up on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show so people can listen. We're going to take a quick break to look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet, and then we'll learn more about owls and that upcoming fun conference. Stay with us. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network, talking today about owls. I'm Larry Mueller. Carla Blum, our guest today, Executive Director of the International Owl Center, located in Houston, Minnesota. Got a great event coming up. We want to talk with her about that. And, of course, we're focusing on owls with her. So if you have questions, maybe about the event, maybe about a particular owl, I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. And we'll be certainly going through the Festival of the Owls schedule of events and a whole lot more with her. Let's take a call from Bob in Crivets next. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning, Larry. How are you? Okay, I should straighten this out. I'm really 20 miles west of Crivets on Calder and Falls. Okay, and I've got a cabin over here, and then I'm from Sheboygan. But, okay, I've got an eastern screech owl. Yesterday morning, the gray phase, a juvenile one, and I had him in here, or it in here, for about 45 minutes. Okay, I do feed suet, sunflower seeds, thistle seed, and corn out here for the animals and the birds. What would this thing prefer to eat outside of rodents? Because he never came down. After 45 minutes, he just left.
Screech owls are generalists also. They eat anything that moves that's small enough. So in the summer, that can include worms and insects, sometimes even bats, mice, voles. And so if you have bird feeders, that's probably whatever is on the ground is attracting little critters that the screech owl is coming in to eat. Or he may just, did you say he's in a shed or an outbuilding or something right now?
Oh, no, I've got him right outside my front. Well, every day at 5:11, I sit down at my dining room table or my workshop bench, and I turn on Larry Mueller Show. It's always interesting. And, okay, these are coming in. I've got probably, well, I don't know, 15 or 16 gray squirrels in the yard, and another two or three, I think there's three right now, red squirrels that come in the yard this time of year. And then, actually, in the summer, I got more chipmunks than I can shake a stick at. But I just wonder, what does he eat there during the, you know, is there something else?
A gray-faced owl, yeah. Okay.
The squirrels would probably be too big for him to eat, even the red squirrels. But chipmunks would probably be on the menu. Birds also, of all kinds, they would eat. So they kind of eat almost anything that's small enough. So in the winter, that is birds and voles and shrews and things like that.
Yeah, so just about anything. Bob, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Say, go take a look at my our Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We've got some great photos coming up now of owls. Greg sent one of a screech owl with a mouse. Apparently, he was looking at, and I'm not sure where he's located. Oh, Village of Oregon. He's looking at a snowy owl at the moment.
Nice.
So there's a snowy owl in southern Wisconsin, and that's we're seeing more snowy owls over the last few years come into Wisconsin, at least for a brief period of time. I'm sure that happens in Minnesota as well, Carla.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and snowy owls, they still don't understand exactly what's going on with these eruptions when they're coming south. The traditional thought was that when you have snowy owls coming south, it's because there's not enough food up in Canada and everybody's starving and they come south. Well, they've realized that a lot of the birds in many of the years when they're coming south are fat and doing quite well. There are two researchers that do studies on their breeding grounds, one in north central Canada, one in Barrow, Alaska, and they've seem to have found some kind of correlation that when there is good breeding, so when there's a lot of lemmings up there and the snowy owls have a lot of babies, because if there's not many lemmings, they won't even lay eggs, or very, very few snowy owls will nest. So their nesting is entirely based on how many lemmings are up there. So if there's a lot of lemmings and all the snowies nest and have a lot of babies, that's when they typically tend to get a lot coming south. Now, last winter, some of the birds that were coming south came early, and those tended not to be doing so well. There were a higher percentage that were starving, and there wasn't much reproduction up north. So it's still not well understood what exactly is happening and why we're getting some of these eruptions. And then, of course, the other thing to be concerned about is climate change, because the tundra is a pretty fragile habitat. And, of course, the lemmings that live there are very dependent on the vegetation there, which is, of course, dependent on the climate, and the snowy owls are dependent on the lemmings. So it all ties together, and nobody's exactly sure, but they know it's probably a pretty delicate balance that they're watching very closely right now to see what may be happening.
Yeah, very interesting. Bill in Madison up next. Hi, Bill. Thank you for calling.
Oh, hi. Thank you for taking my call. Great program. I've been a lifetime owl lover, and I grew up in northeast Wisconsin, and my hometown was near a very large swamp. So me and my buddy, we were 18, we'd go get a six-pack of beer, and we'd go park out in the swamp and drink. And we started hearing barred owls, and we didn't know what they were. And my buddy could imitate these owls like any animal, actually. He was amazing. So he started calling to these owls, and as soon enough, there's another one. And pretty soon we're surrounded by like three barred owls screeching at us, and we're just laughing our butts off. And, you know, so every once in a while, that's what we do. Our entertainment would go and call the owls in. So I just wanted to share that with you.
Yeah, barred owls are very responsive to calling, probably more so than great horns and even screeches. They're very, very responsive, and it's not too hard to imitate them, and you don't have to be that good, but they're the ones that do the, there you go.
There we go.
They also do some very other strange sounds, this bizarre caterwauling. They also do a scream that sounds like a woman being murdered, that's kind of a, So if you didn't know what it was, it would freak you out. Yeah. But when you're calling and they're responding, they are responding because they're perceiving an intruder in their territory. So typically, this is something we will do for educational purposes, but when we do it, we're very conscious that we're not going to the same place over and over again because it is causing some stress to the owls. If you're doing it occasionally, it's not going to cause any significant problems. But do bear in mind that it is not legal to call owls in some places, especially high-traffic places. Like national parks may be a place where it's questionable and probably not advisable to call owls because there's so many people that are using them, and the birds would basically just be harassed by it. So be conscious that if you are calling owls, you're doing it with respect for the bird, so that you're only doing it occasionally in the same location, not regularly.
Sounds great. That, Bill, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And Carla, you know, I'm looking over the Festival of Owls schedule of events, and it's March 3rd
to the 5th.
Through the 5th. Talk about that festival, because, man, does it sound fun.
Yeah, the festival is hard to describe in a few words other than just total owl immersion. It's everything you could imagine doing pertaining to owls and then some. So we always have live owl programs. We usually have the Illinois Raptor Center. That's who we'll be having this year. And they do 5 live owl programs, and they bring 6 different species and usually more than one of each bird. So that includes a flying barn owl and a live snowy owl. So those are usually the stars. And we do a lot of family things. So there's kids' crafts, kids' activities, kids' art projects. And we have all kinds of owl-themed vendors, owl-themed food. The Lutheran Church does an owl-faced pancake breakfast. The coffee shop in town has owl-themed coffees. Everybody really in town gets into it. Excuse me. And really, to get a feel for it, you have to go to the website. Now, we do have some really special things going on this year that are kind of one-time things. And one of them is chainsaw carving of a standing dead tree in City Park. Emerald ash borer, unfortunately, hit Houston this last year.
Oh, too bad.
We pretty much lost all of our ash trees in town. But the city council was thinking ahead, and they said, you know what? We're not going to cut these trees off down at ground level. Let's cut them off 10 feet up, and we're going to have them chainsaw carved. So they'll become art pieces. Excuse me. And so we're sponsoring one of those trees to have a whole bunch of owls carved into it during the Owl Festival. So you'll actually get to watch the chainsaw carver. And that will be added to our Parade of Owls art tour. We already have 10 public owl sculptures located throughout Houston that are publicly viewable year-round. So this will be added to that tour. Another fun thing that we're doing is a group paint project. So Laurel Bay, an artist from Colorado who's come to the festival many times, is going to be doing this and leading it. She'll have a really big canvas. Everybody that comes by that wants to participate gets to draw a colorful squiggle or mark or something on the canvas, and then you sign your name on the back. And she, over the course of the Owl Fest, will help shape that into a giant kind of graffiti-style owl face that we will keep then permanently, and everybody that's been a part of it will have their name signed on the back. So that will be really fun also. And there's a video of that. If you go to the festival homepage, you can kind of see a project where she's done this before to see kind of how it turns out. And it's really amazing. And the big thing this year is we're going to be showing the USA premiere of the film The Secret Life of Owls.
Ah.
Yeah. So it has aired in Canada. It's a film about great horned owls. And, of course, we're in it because we're kind of the leaders of the owl behavioral and vocal.
Sure.
For great horned owls. So we've got a little 5-minute spot in there. But it's aired in Canada on the CBC and has not aired in the United States yet. And we're going to air it for the very first time at the Owl Festival. And two of the cinematographers, Neil Reddig and Laura Johnson, are going to be on hand to talk about making the film and answer questions about it.
Boy, that sounds really fun.
Yeah.
To have them there as well. To answer questions and make comments is just, that's fantastic.
I know. We're thrilled to be able to have them come. And so we're also very thankful to Make Believe Media for letting us show the premiere before they have the release dates in the U.S. set up yet.
Oh, that's great. And now, you know, somebody might say, well, I'm here in Wisconsin. Where the heck is Houston, Minnesota?
Yeah, most people say, where the heck is Houston in Minnesota? What? We're just 30 minutes west of La Crosse. So we're not far away at all.
Yeah, and it's pretty easy to find. And of course, your site, which we have a link on our Facebook page to your site, but tell people where your site is located.
The website?
Yeah.
The internationalowlcenter.org is the Owl Center website, and then we have a separate entire website just for the festival, and that one is festivalofowls.com. There's simply so much to the festival that it deserved its own whole entire website.
Oh.
There's a lot of information. Oh, and I didn't even mention the World Owl Hall of Fame. That's one of the things that makes us very international is we present awards. We solicit the nominations. We don't do the judging. We have internationally known owl experts do the judging. But we present awards to people who have dedicated their lives to making the world a better place for owls. And they come to the festival to receive their awards and speak. So this year we'll have a man from Japan who studies the Blakiston's fish owl, which is an endangered species and arguably the largest owl species on the planet. We will also have Jonathan Slatt, who's from the Twin Cities but works in the Russian Far East, also studying the Blakiston's fish owl. And Dr. Ralph Gutierrez from California, who's been studying spotted owls his whole life. And, oh, man, does he have stories about the politics of that in addition to the owls themselves.
Well, that all sounds just great. By the way, if you're near your computer, you should go to my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show, and take a look at some of the photos that are up there, because Carla, because I'm just looking now. Is the title of our Facebook page is The Larry Mueller Show, and Owen yep. just posted a photo of a great gray in flight descending on a prey. That is really a cool, cool photo. And there are several other photos.
Nice.
Yeah, Daniel sent, I don't know if you can see the next one, a photo and wondering, what is this particular?
I already answered that one. That one was an eastern screech owl.
Yeah, I was pretty sure you answered that one. That's a little one. Screech owls are little guys.
Small guys with ear tufts.
Yeah, small guys with ear tufts. But that photo of Owen of the great gray is
fantastic, and it's a natural shot, which is a nice thing. I guess controversy to say the least about photography of owls. It's very, very popular, and more people have big lenses these days. And something that has kind of taken off that's quite controversial is baiting owls. So you go to the pet store, you buy a little mouse, you go out there and you throw it out and wait for the owl to come down and eat it and then get a nice flying shot of it. And there's been a lot of debate about whether this is safe or ethical or whatever, and it's a very heated topic. And it's nice to see photos that aren't from baited owls like that. So there's been discussion of is there potential for disease transmission? Is there potential for habituating the birds to look to humans for food? And I personally have heard anecdotes of that happening. And then there's also the anecdotes of people who were not paying attention to what they were doing and baited an owl across the road that was hit by a car.
Oh.
Yeah, it has happened. So it's something that I don't encourage.
Encourage, yeah. Mike in Madison has something for us as well. Mike, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to ask, do any of the owls migrate in addition to the snowy owl? And which are all the owls protected species? And are any endangered owls?
All right, good questions.
Several questions there. So migratory, the snowies would be considered more nomadic than migratory because it's not a regular north-south pattern. They kind of wander around and can wind up in different places. So it's not a true migration. The one that's considered to be a true migrant would be the northern saw-whet owl. And even then, it's not as pat as you would expect it to be for a migratory species. There's a lot of folks studying their banding them, and they're finding band recoveries hundreds of miles away, and sometimes they go east instead of north, or so they don't all follow the patterns. They'd be considered migratory. Sedentary ones resident on territory year-round would be great horns, bard, screech. Long-eared and short-eared would be considered nomadic. And I see Scott has a wonderful picture of long-eared owls on your Facebook page also. And the fun thing about long-eared is they do these communal roosts in winter. You don't think of owls hanging out together, but long-eared do in the winter. And you can see up to 24 hanging out together in the same cluster of trees, and they'll be there most of the winter, and then they disperse and breed during the summer. Now, there was another part to that question, which was... I forgot.
Oh, I forgot, too!
I talked too long!
Well, I should have remembered.
Oh, are they protected species?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yes. All native bird species are protected. So that includes all owls. That includes literally robins, blue jays, your feeder birds, anything except house sparrows, starlings, and pigeons for the most part, and non-native things like pheasants are considered protected species. So you literally need a permit even just to have a feather. So everybody knows that about eagles. Some people know it about owls, but most people don't realize that those molted feathers you find under your bird feeder, you can't technically keep. And that goes back to the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, back to the days when the ladies wore the big hats with the big feathers on them, and people were killing the birds for the feathers. And there's no way to tell if a feather has been naturally molted or if it's been plucked. So when they protected birds, they protect the birds, their nests, their feathers, their eggs, their pieces and parts, the live bird, the dead bird. So that's why that comes up that way.
And another photo on our Facebook page, Rob Hultz at the Open Door Bird Sanctuary, holding Coco, the cutest little screech owl. There we go. So there are lots of great photos.
Coco's a saw-wet owl.
A saw-wet owl, you're right. Gary in Boscobel has a question.
Okay.
Thank you, Larry. I've been spending a lot of time all my life outdoors and doing a little bit of monitoring of owls at night, tracking calling and nesting habits. And I have seen what looks to me like quite a sharp decline in owl populations. And I'm wondering if the Owl Center is doing any monitoring of owl calling and breeding activity, and whether they have found a decline in owls as well as I have.
Oh, good question. That's something that as we grow and move into the future, I would like to get in that, because it's something that's very poorly understood and very hard to get a handle on. So as far as owl population numbers, there is almost nothing in the United States that would be an accurate estimate of a species, how many exist of a species, spotted owls being a noted exception because they're very well studied. Otherwise, typically the way they survey for birds would be to go out and play a call and then listen for birds to call back. You're only going to get the territory-holding adults to call back. And what happens when young ones disperse in the fall, they become non-territorial floaters, which means they don't have their own territory. They're staying out of everybody's way. And because they don't want to get their butts kicked by territory holders, they don't say anything. So you can't detect them on a playback survey. So there's no way to really accurately detect the complete population. The Great Lakes Monitoring Program, a nocturnal owl monitoring program, is for Minnesota and Wisconsin, and it's a volunteer-based project where you go out one night a year, and it's passive listening. So you're not going to get a population level from that, but you're going to be able to detect trends because it's very standardized. If you use playback, well, you might have a heck of a sound system that the owls really can hear, and I might have a wimpy one. So you can't standardize that. But if we all just go out and listen 5 minutes at each of 10 stations, we're going to have the same detection probability. So if people are doing this year after year after year, and now they're getting a significant number of years of data, they can at least detect trends to see are they increasing or decreasing. So that's about all anybody can say at this time. And again, it's quite low detection rates because it's only passive listening. So surveying owl populations is pretty difficult unless you have a lot of people working on it. In Europe, they've got some fantastic models for this. My husband is from the Netherlands and helped found the Little Owl Working Group in the Netherlands. They also have a Barn Owl Working Group and an Eagle Owl Working Group.
And they're all doing a lot of great work. And here we are out of time. Oh, my goodness. This has been so much fun. Carla, I know you're going to have a great time at your Owl Festival, and I hope you'll come back and be with us again. This is so much fun, and I would look forward to another visit. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. I will talk about owls anytime.
All right, and that Owl Festival, our Festival of Owls, March 3rd through the 5th. Go to our website, and you'll find a whole lot more.